Hi, Krista. This is Isham speaking for the audio test. Can you hear me?
Loud and clear. Can you hear me?
Yes, I can hear you. Thank you.
Thanks.
All right, can I ask everyone to take their seats, please, and we will start.
Have we got everybody?
No, but we're getting there.
We haven't got Robin yet.
Oh, we don't have your speakers, you say?
Oh, we've got all the important people here.
Well,
okay.
We've got
enough of the important people.
If I could ask someone in staff to go outside, and if there's any at-large people out there, gather them in.
It'll hug.
Well, more in the sense of hurting, but... Wafa, welcome.
Can I something before resolving the problem of Mr. Tijani? I was in the Universal Acceptance Working Group, and they were seeking some outreach, and I suggested that the best place to make some outreach is ALAC and ALSS, but they said that they reached you. They didn't receive any cooperation message to make some outreach about universal acceptance. So they asked me, since I was an ALAC member, to try to contact you on this issue. I don't know. They said they contacted several people from ALAC to make some outreach about universal acceptance. But they didn't receive any feedback. They did receive? They did receive?
No. They did.
Certainly at times in the past we have interchanged with them. I'm not sure which particular request or when. If you could find out and let me know, I'd appreciate it.
Okay, I will try to have his name because I was attending the session without knowing the names.
All right, thank you. Welcome. This is the work session X. I'm not quite sure what X is. I think it's 5-4? All right. I think it's 5, but well, it doesn't really matter. Whatever number it is, it's now. And what we are... sorry, we're sort of informal. This is a session on UGTLD subsequent procedures for future rounds or whatever. And we have identified 4 topics that we'll be talking about. And we have the team leaders from each of the groups who will be presenting. And I will turn it over to Cheryl to introduce the individual speakers and the topics. And I think we're going to try to allocate about 20 minutes each. Probably 7-8 minutes or something like that, talking, and then an opportunity for questions and discussion. And Cheryl, I'll turn it over to you.
Thank you, Alan. I appreciate that. Cheryl Langdonnell for the transcript record. And for our friends who are perhaps not as familiar with the ALAC and regional leaders meetings, the reason you've all got tent cards is because if you want to speak, you do that with it. That is your universal sign for someone to note that you wish to be in the speaking queue. It also helps us know who's who. And along who's who, I'm going to immediately introduce a co-chair here, Jeff, and I will do a little round robin of each of the work track leads, noting that we do not have leads from all work tracks in our PDP process here. We have work track leads from the topic that you've identified you and your communities have a particular interest in. So you all know me, far too much about me in some cases. Jeff, brief intro.
Yes, Jeff Newman. I apologize right now for my voice. It seemed to have disappeared this morning. It's coming back somewhat. As Cheryl said, I'm one of the overall co-chairs of the PDP subsequent procedures, PDP working group. Our work is divided into 5 now work tracks. Each work track has responsibility for a different area. Looking around the table to see which work tracks we have here. I know I see... Oh, there we go. I see Karen Day. There's Karen. Can wave. She is with work track 3. Sorry, I got to stand up. Javier and Martin from work track 5.
Sarah
is number here. Oh, there we go. Sarah from work track 1.
And Krista.
And Krista is listening in.
And speaking.
So, again, we have on here the topics that you all had requested to talk about. If there is time and there are other subjects, we'd be happy to address them. And really, I just want to have the work track leaders talk because they are doing a fantastic job, and I will fill in as necessary. So with that, should we just go over to the first topic, which is the geonames issue, work track 5.
Let's start with the easy stuff.
Yeah, we'll start with the easy, and then, so I will turn that over to Martin and Javier.
Martin Sutton here. Sorry, did we have any slide for this? Or and then I can just talk through those.
And if we can put the slides up full size on the right-hand side also.
Do we have anything? Oh, thank you. Yeah, moot. Oh, I can't read that from here. Thank you for this. So work track 5 is has only been one of the most recent work tracks commenced. So this was towards the end of last year. It was an issue that has a lot of interest across the community in different pockets of the community. So the approach to this was to encourage wide participation and to focus on the specific topic. So a lot of the other work tracks you'll notice have a vast quantity of topics that they have tried to address through their activities. This is purely focused on geotherms. So the essential part of this is that there is a gap between policy that was created in 2007 by the GNSO and the final output of the applicant guidebook in 2012. So some of these were looked at. So some of the geographic terms were restricted, so nobody could apply for a particular type of geotherm, or there were some other treatments, such as a request for approval by the local authority, or a non-objection letter. So there was different aspects provided to different terms specified in the applicant guidebook. This has been somewhat confusing to some as to what they could or could not apply for, or perhaps felt that it was too much of a risk to apply for in 2012. The difficulty is understanding if there was that demand because of the restrictions that were applied. So we don't know who would have otherwise entertained an application, including from local governments. So it could well have been the restriction imposed prevented governments from actually applying for a three-letter country code or a country name. So the work track 5 has specifically set out at the end of last year to work through how the treatment was viewed for the 2012 round, and for each of the terms specified within the applicant guidebook, we are currently looking at the pros and cons, if you like, of the treatment, what worked well and the purpose and intent of the treatment, and what didn't work so well. So did it actually prevent things from being applied for that would have otherwise been opened up in that space? Going through those particular elements, we will then look at whether that treatment needs to be adjusted or come up with alternative ideas as to those particular aspects, and also to explore what wasn't included in the applicant guidebook. So if there are geographic terms that were not specified, that there needs to be a discussion about whether there should be particular treatments applied in the future. This work track will also be looking at considering those as well. To the stage that we are at the moment, we've gone through and created a terms of reference for the work track. So that was agreed in January, early February. I think I'm losing a sense of time at the moment. It is. So we've worked through the terms of reference. One of the challenges here is that obviously we have tried to attract a wide audience into this group. So there are lots of different opinions to work through. So the terms of reference did take a bit of time to settle down so that we came up with a working document that everybody was happy to work with. So the terms of reference did take a while to get through. Nevertheless, that's given us a good platform now to start all of the actual hard work and discussions that are now going on. So for the leadership of that, we have a shared leadership, as you'll note, from ALAC, CCNSO, the GAC, and the GNSO. So we have appointed co-leaders from each of those groups, illustrating that it's similar to a cross-community type activity, but it fits into the GNSO policy development work as well. So that's where we are at the moment. We have also experienced the point where, because there is a lot of interest, and we have, I can't remember how many sign-ups, but it was around about 150 once I looked. 145. So quite a lot of members from different pockets of the community, some of which were not familiar with the 2007 policy development work, nor the applicant guidebook activities that were largely pushed through by demand from the GAC environment, the CCNSO environment. So what we've worked on is also creating a lot of information resources for people to get up to speed and help with those conversations in that work track. And we've also recently held a webinar session very much going around the background, talking people through the background and steps that have gone through to where we are now. So that's available for anybody also that wants to join the group to work through a set of resources that brings them up to speed so that they can feel effective in terms of contributing to that work effort. I shall stop there and see if there's anything else to add from my colleagues. Thank you.
Javier Ruajoet, for the record, welcome to Puerto Rico. Well, as you know, I'm new at the Work Track 5. I think what's, and you know, that the equities here on both sides are equally important, and that's what gives it its complexities. You know, for on the one side, geonames as collective concerns or even sovereign concerns, and on the other right, private rights and individual concerns like freedom of speech and freedom of communication or usage of words. And it's a type of issue that brings a lot of attention to a topic. So that's, you see all the effervescence into this type of discussion. And that's why you have this shared leadership model to reflect all concerns. So I'm just want to say that I know this is a important work track, and I hope I can, you know, comply with its requirements, and very happy to be in this position. Thank you.
And with that, I'm very happy to open up to any questions. Sorry, I forgot the rule that was just explained to me. Please go ahead, Holly.
Holly Reich for the Transcript Records. You, in the very beginning, started off with this, there was a gap between 2007 and 2012. Now, am I asking too much to say what was the nature of the gap that you talked about?
So there are a variety. So each of the specified terms, geographic terms that are contained within the applicant guidebook, may have a variation of what was originally set out in the GNSO policy. So what we have existing in GNSO policy from 2007 does not match up with what was put into the applicant guidebook due to a number of other processes through GAC advice, through other comment periods that were applied in the creation of the applicant guidebook. So what we are actually doing at the moment within the work track is going through each of those, showing clearly the differences in treatment from what was originally specified as principles of the 2007 policy versus the resultant applicant guidebook. Now, that's an interesting point, because at the moment, if we're looking at trying to make sure that policy drives our activities going forward, we do already have a piece of work within the Work Track 5 which needs to address that gap and see whether we need to recommend going forward with what was contained within the applicant guidebook, or revert to the 2007 policy, or something in between, or something completely different.
Just to follow on, so you're treating the 2007 as actual policy, and you're treating the subsequent guidebook as a deviation of policy, or something along those lines?
Well, the Work Track 5 is looking at what those differences are, and we need to make sure that when we complete the work, that there is something embedded in the policy that reflects future application rounds. So we recognise that there is a difference between the policy results of 2007 and what was set out in the applicant guidebook. So that's our first mission, is to make sure that everybody is aware of what that difference is. And we are discussing, you know, whether there's benefits in the way it was finally treated, in which case we could perhaps recommend some of these are carried forward as policy, as what was put into the applicant guidebook, or where we think that there should be some changes made, whether that reverts back to a 2007 policy or something completely different. That is the whole point of the work track 5, to assess that and consider any recommendations.
Yeah. One can debate whether some of the changes, some of the things that were put in the applicant guidebook were a change in policy or were implementation. But at this point, our intent is to decide how the next process will work, regardless of why the changes may have been made or if it was a sin or proper work. The history, to some extent, of how we got here doesn't matter. But now we need something definitive going forward. We have a queue of Tijani, I believe, and then Christopher.
Thank you, Alan. Tijani speaking. This issue of geographic names is today. By the way, it wasn't a very big issue for the past round, and now it is a very big issue because there is a very big conflict between for Dot Amazon and also for Patagonia. I don't know if you know about it. So now there is a problem, and the problem is essentially between two interests: the political interest, governments, and the commercial interest. And those two parties try to make us go to the trap and lobby for their interest. We don't have, as at large, because we are defending the interest of end users, we don't have to go to this trap. We have to always look to the interest of the community, to interest of end users, and I think the community applications should have a priority for the geographic names, because we need people to have the possibility to speak, to express their point of view. So the community, when they have the TLD, they can express their point of view through this TLD, and they can make use of it also to have an identity on the net, etc. So I think one of the best way to address this issue is to prioritize the community applications. Thank you.
Thank you. And just to sort of raise a point for both the last two remarks, what we didn't have before the 2012 round was a vast amount of experience in this. So what we do have now is some expectations of what may occur in the future and the opportunity to make any corrective action that might make it easier or at least understandable for some as to what risks they may be taking to apply for certain terms. So the predictability element is something that we need to try and help address. We may not solve everything, and I doubt we ever will, but at least we can have an opportunity to improve based on lessons learnt from the last round and the experiences that we've seen over the last few years.
Jeff wanted to get in.
Thank you. There's somebody next to you to speak in the queue?
I think Jeff wanted a comment right now in response.
Yeah, thanks. Jeff Newman. Three points I just wrote down on the last comments. I want to clarify, because I think often we are thinking now about the two situations you mentioned, the Amazon Patagonia, and you had put that as commercial interests against the political interests. I think it's very careful we stay away from the term commercial interests, because at the end of the day, it could be a nonprofit organization that applies for a name that shares, coincidentally, the name of a village, a river, a town, a mountain, a statue, whatever it is of cultural significance somewhere else in the world. So it's dangerous to portray this issue as just commercial versus political. The second thing on that, there also is, in this, and it's not just with this geographic issue, it rears its head in other issues as well. But there seems to be a mentality of people, when they think about top-level domains, to think about the one model of making domain name registrations available to third parties and somehow distributing it, whether it's selling it, giving it away. But I think that's a very narrow view of potential uses of the DNS. There are other uses. And whether it's a brand top-level domain that uses it internally to benefit consumers, or whether it's just used in some other innovative way. We need to think beyond the current .com old models and think ahead as to how the DNS can be used. And so I would urge that when we're talking about this debate, that we need to just think about potential uses and not set a rule that limits the flexibility to innovate.
Yeah. We're running out of time, so I'd like to limit questions and answers right now. And can we start using the timer? We'll start with a two-minute and reduce. We are about 20 minutes into this session of a 20-minute session. So at this point, we're taking time away from the other sessions. We have Christopher and then myself.
Okay, two minutes. I think we should close the book on the 2007 stuff. It was not a consensus, quite evidently, because it had to be changed before it could be implemented. And I think we're wasting a lot of time on the claiming that it was a policy. I think that provokes a lot of people into feeling that GNSO is trying to grasp onto something that they never had. I'd also ask the question, what exactly does the PDP mean when it discusses freedom of speech? For me, the freedom of speech that we're talking about is very similar to the freedom of speech that Tajani was just referring to. It's the freedom of speech of the registrant, not the registry.
Okay. I just wanted to recount something. At the end of Abu Dhabi, the ALAC holds, end of every annual general meeting, the ALAC holds a developmental session for the new ALAC to get people working together. And one of the things we did this time is we held a sample policy discussion just to go through the mechanics of how can we come to decisions and how can we evolve an ALAC position on something. And the sample topic we took was geonames as TLDs. And I was somewhat surprised that we did come to consensus. There was one or two people who disagreed, but we came to consensus. And the consensus was we didn't care what the outcome was, but it shouldn't end up with absolute winners and losers. That we need to come to some level of compromise where no one may be perfectly happy, but somehow we can go forward without losers. Because either the GAC losing or all commercial interests losing, and forgive me for using the word commercial, was not a way that we wanted to go forward. So I just thought I'd relate that.
Let's hope that it similarly happens in the work track that way.
We just decided what we wanted. We didn't have to figure out how to make it work. We have the last speaker, Sebastian.
Thank you. First of all, I want to support what my colleague Christopher says. I agree with him. And I want to take the opportunity, because it's the first time I am able to say that. I am very, very surprised that WIS considers that guidebook is a Bible, and then we just need to change a few things if we find an agreement. We will never find an agreement to change things, because it was done by people who wanted one way, and the things will not evolve. Then I think we are spending time for, unfortunately, we are losing our time, and that's a pity. We need to have a new policy for some of the issue, and not to take into account what was the policy at that time. And I just want to remind you that it was not the first round of TLD. It seems that people are discovering questions that we are talking about the geoname. It was already a discussion under .info, and therefore, if we want to learn, we can learn. We will learn after the next round, and we will learn and learn, but don't forget to learn from what's past round. The 2004 was very useful, or could have been very useful. Sorry.
Thank you. Back to you, Cheryl.
Oh, thank you very much, Alan. Cheryl Langdonell for the transcript record. Now, I'm just desperately trying to work out which was our next topic because it's not very easy for me to see if it's up there on the agenda. Let's just click over to the next slide. In fact, we should have already done so. So if we progress already, one more slide and another after that. There we go, work track three. So, and welcome, Robin. Karen and Robin, which one of you are going to lead off on these topics? Well, here are our concerns. Community priority evaluation. Who's going to take it? Go for it, Robin. Over to you.
Hi, my name is Robin Gross. I'm the co-lead of Work Track 3. So some of the issues that we're working on, concerns about the community priority evaluation, also known as the CPE, particularly the results, the strictness of the criteria and the way they were interpreted by the evaluators. There was some conflicting decisions, so we need to tighten that up a little bit. Concerns about the CPE process and the level of transparency. Note the ICANN board resolved in 2016 that ICANN undertake an independent review of the CPE process. So what's the current status? Well, the working team has considered a number of available resources, such as the Council of Europe report, the data on outcomes of the CPE in 2012, GAC advice, et cetera. And we've sought input from the community leaders and the applicant support working group and developed a set of draft recommendations and questions for community input to include in the initial report that is about to go out. Next slide. Okay, so what are some of our preliminary recommendations and implementation guidance? We need to increase the transparency and the predictability in the application process. We need to have the evaluations done in a shorter period of time, the application evaluations done in a shorter period of time, and the procedures need to be developed before the process opens. We can't have it changing in midstream, so to speak. And we need to have more opportunity for dialogue and clarifying questions with the applicants in the CPE process. Other fixes would be less restrictive word counts for the communities to engage in clarifying and providing information on their applications. So now we've got some things that we want to get input back from the community on some of our questions that are still sort of hanging over us. And really one of the most important issues that we're grappling with right now and would really like to get some feedback on is how to define community for the purposes of a community-based GTLD applications. So one of the there seems to be a consensus that we need to have a definition for what a community is. But what we don't really have consensus for is what that definition should be. We've got a lot of different ideas. Some people have suggested we need to have different types of communities that have different types of rights and privileges associated as opposed to the sort of one-size-fits-all process. So let me sort of ask this group at large, how would you define a community for these purposes? What are the attributes that we should be looking at and considering? And again, we need to think about what is the overall goal of this community process? What is the public interest objectives that we're trying to achieve by creating this concept of community priority? So what do you guys think? If we could get some feedback on how to define community for these purposes, it would be really helpful. Okay, Tani, please.
Thank you, Robin. You are absolutely right to say that there is no consensus about the definition of the community, exactly like the impossibility to have the common definition of the public interest. So we are a little bit stuck, but I think that we have to do something so that we will not stay there. Several kind of communities, yes, we can have, but I can tell you that a number of registry can make an application as a community, and they are a community. Shall they be treated exactly like if, for example, the Amharic language community asking for a TLD? No. So the definition of a community, I think it is a little bit known, but what kind of community we will give priority or will give advantage? Thank you.
Thank you. Did anyone else want to weigh in on this? Yes, please.
Robin,
please.
You'll need your ears, Robin, unless you're very good at Spanish.
We've got Jonathan and Olivia. I think Olivia was first.
Alberto Soto speaking. In my opinion, defining what a community is okay. Sorry. I think that it's relatively easy to find a definition of community if we look it up in the dictionary. The issue is if we are going to work with different types of communities, we will have different types of solutions for each of those communities, each of which will shrink the problem at the time of defining, but will enlarge the problems in terms of the treatment to be given to each community. And that might spark conflicts because the treatments will be different. I think that will increase complexity if we split into different communities at the time of resolution and bring about problems. A community is simply a group of people with the same interests. It could be religious, educational, whatever, etc. Thank you.
Thank you very much. One of the things that we've talked about is, as you mentioned, having these different types of communities. And the reason for this was because there was this assumption that different communities have different needs, that maybe a community that's geared towards brands would have a different set of needs than a community that's geared more towards religious or nonprofit interests, for example. And so the thought is maybe to try to tailor the different needs to the needs of the community to the types of assistance that's provided to them in the process. So I think that's sort of where we were trying to get at with the thought of, well, maybe what we want to do is have different types of communities. And that was something that came from the GAC in our meeting with the GAC in the last ICANN meeting, was some suggestions that maybe if we try to think about it in this way, things might fall into place a little bit easier if we have different buckets as opposed to trying to put everything into one bucket and then deciding, you know, everyone gets the same assistance for that. So that's just sort of the thought there. Yeah.
Okay. We have a queue at this point of Jonathan, Olivia, and Eduardo. Jonathan.
Thanks. Jonathan Zook from the Innovators Network Foundation. And I'm also the chair of the CCT review, but I'm speaking in my personal capacity on this question of community TLDs. Having spent the last couple of years looking at this, I think that it defies definition, and that what we've found is that the current model pushes everyone to a specific business model, which is an open TLD and trying to just sell as many second-level domains as you possibly can. And so that has an impact on a number of different alternative models, as Jeff brought up earlier, whether it's community-driven or something else where I'm just trying to make a creative use of the TLD, I'm economically incented to do one specific model. And I think changing that economic incentive around is the answer, more so than trying to come up with all of these individual carve-outs that defy definition. In other words, if we find a lower barrier to entry, a lower barrier to maintenance, lower minimums, etc., that allow people to really experiment with the DNS, I think we'll solve the problems of community better than trying to define it.
Who was next in the queue?
Olivier.
Yeah, thanks, Olivier Crépin-Ablon speaking. I actually have a question as to whether WorkTrack 3 has considered the definitions used by the Economist Intelligence Unit as to what a community is in their appraisal back for the previous round, and also whether it has looked at the definition of community as the dot health objection was refused by the examiners at the time, because dot health was not a community, or the health community was not a community, and it was a community objection that we had filed. Did you look into this?
I don't think we looked at the economist definition. If you've got that handy, I would certainly welcome it, because this, again, is something that we're really grappling with. So if you've got some material for us to chew on, that would be really helpful. I don't think we also had anything that was specific on .health either. We have invited a number of community applicants who went through the process and either had good experience or bad experience to come talk with us and relate their experience, but I don't believe the .health folks came for that. Karen, did you want to clarify that?
If I heard you correctly, the definition that you were referring to was the EIT? Yeah.
So the Economist Intelligence Unit, EIU, they didn't come up with a definition, but they determined through some unknown process that, for example, .gay was not a community.
Right.
Which was a rather interesting thought, since I've always heard of the gay community,
but
their things it wasn't. So
let Karen answer.
That was, we did talk about that definition, and we sort of, we called it very affectionately our straw bunny, that our former esteemed colleague, Avery Doria, helped. She is still esteemed. She's just not, she's formerly of the PDP. Was instrumental in crafting definition to try and fill in some of those gaps that we felt were evident by that. But quite honestly, we did not get a lot of uptake and participation in specific ways of improvement, and that's where we are now, and that's what our questions to the community are going to be, you know, are based around, is, you know, how can we write this time to alleviate that again? But yes, we have talked about that, but as far as anybody giving us a specific proposal, something that we can really meld with, we're not quite there yet.
This is Cheryl Langdon-Orr. Wait a second. This is Cheryl Langdon-Orr for the transcript record. And at the moment, the transcript record says man, woman, woman, man, woman, because you're not saying who you are when you start your interventions. Housekeeping, please. State who you are when you start speaking.
It is Alan Greenberg speaking. And I must make one comment to alleviate the EIU's methodology, if not definition, has been reviled by almost everyone. I'm not sure we want to use that as our model. Jeff?
It's Olivier speaking. I would have said as a model we should not pursue.
Ah.
That was why. But sometimes it's better to see what you don't like to choose something that you like on the menu. Thank you.
Jeff?
Yeah, thanks. Just to follow up on the dot.
That is Jeff Newman speaking.
Jeff Newman. Yes, that's me.
For the record.
For the record. Or man. I like that, actually.
How are you feeling about woman?
That's not so great. I mean, it's great, but not for me. It's really great.
It's on All right. the record.
It's just it's, infrequent.
For the record, it's fantastic. For my wife, it's awesome. Okay. So I don't... my point, sorry, was on the .health objection. I'm just trying to figure out... We did hear about some different issues for Work Track 3 on the .health objection, mostly related to the interaction between the independent objector and also in relation to the at-large objection. But I'm not sure the point you're making on the definition of community. So can... If we have a second, just clarify what the connection was.
Quick clarification.
Yeah, it's Olivier Crépin-Leblanc speaking. And so the objection was made by the at-large community. So it was a community objection for .health. And that was rejected because the at-large was not seen as being a community that was related to .health in one way or other, et cetera, et cetera, et cetera. So, sorry?
Understood, but did you have a view that it was wrong, it was right?
I have never got any views about anything.
Oh, sorry. I have views, but I don't think this is the time to discuss
No, it's certainly speaking. Obviously, we were upset because a lot of work went into this. But obviously, you know, at the end of the day, these are little things which looked like loopholes or something that could be fixed somehow. But I think the EIU was the thing, though, that was, I think, probably more significant, and that we felt as the community, the ALAC actually did write a statement about this and complained about the treatment of the applications by the EIU. And in fact, even before the EIU progressed forward, there was a question being put as to what knowledge does the EIU have about communities, especially in our context, to be able to make those judgment calls. And so maybe this is one thing that we need to look at. And I'm not quite sure whether you do have the scoring method that the EIU used to choose what a community was or not, but perhaps that's one thing that you can try and find and quietly put to the side and say, well, that's not what we're going to use. Thanks.
Eduardo.
Thank you, Mr. Chair. This is Eduardo Diaz for the record. You were asking ideas on how to define community, and I hear what Jonathan said about business. The way I see it, anybody that applies for a new GTLD has a business in mind. I don't think they're going to give it away. So knowing that, this definition of community, I will say, you know, that anybody that has a non-for-profit organization should be the community, because it's not for business. It's for some kind of charity, I don't know. And if you define community that way, then that's it. But then you have to say, well, is it non-for-profit has the same connotation in around the world? Maybe not. You can have a community in Tanzania that wants a GTLD, and I doubt they will incorporate a non-for-profit. So, you know, you have to balance these things. So that's an idea to consider. Thank you.
Just to note, the concept of not-for-profit varies around the world. Not everyone has that concept. John?
John LaPrise, for the record. So rather than come up with a definition of community from scratch, so of course I ask the internet and Google comes up with a couple of definitions that I've posted in the chat log, but they're incredibly broad. You know, a feeling of fellowship with others. Let's see, someone shared common attitudes, interests, and goals. So if we start with the super broad, who are we trying to exclude? So take the broadest definition and start chopping or start chipping away at the definition to exclude those groups that we feel should not have access to this. So maybe it's a process of reduction rather than addition. Thank you.
We'll go on this topic for about another 5 minutes, so we have a little bit more time. If there's anyone. Kylie.
Thank you, Alan. Kylie Khan, for the record. I just want to say one thing. As far as I know, the Human Rights Commission of the United Nations so far still has not been able to define exactly what are humans. So if that's the case, well, don't worry about the definitions. Just keep on working on it, and that's it. Thank you.
Jeff.
Yeah, Jeff Newman. Not on the human rights issue, but on one thing we also need to think about, especially with the statement of, well, if you're not for profit, then maybe you're representing the community. There also has to be a strong nexus between the community and the string. So just because someone's a nonprofit, so let's say in the United States, lawyers are members of the American Bar Association. They may be a community for the term ABA, but are they a community for the term law? Mm. Right? So those are the types of things. It's not just are you a community, but are you the community, and is there a strong enough nexus between you as the not-for-profit, let's say, and the string itself?
I put myself in the queue. One of the issues that I think the working group has to tackle is how widespread that community has to be.
I could make a case that I could put together a group of genealogists in Montreal. And I'm pretty sure we could make a strong case that we are representative of all the genealogists, professional genealogists in that area. But does that give us a big enough community to use the term genealogist as a top-level domain when there's millions of them around the world that we don't represent? Is it enough if I have all the Canadian genealogists, all the North American ones, all the English-speaking ones? I think we're going to have to give guidance to whoever has to make these judgments of just how wide a community do you have to be before you can get the name. And it's something that was clearly not well specified last time, and varying definitions were used for different applications. And that's something we can't stand in the future, of having varying definitions being used in different cases, at least in my mind. Thank you. We have Christopher, and I will close the queue at that point.
Just a gloss on what you've just said. We have had historically exactly that problem with that question with .edu, mutatis mutandis, and I know from experience that there was a time when, I think it was Becky Burr rang me up and said, what do the Europeans think about the expansion of .edu? And I consulted the internet community in the European Union, and everybody said, but we've got .ac in all our ccTLDs, so we don't want .edu. But that was one solution. But you see the point.
Yeah. Although my university had in Canada had a .edu. We never used it, but we had it. Mm. We still may have it, for all I know. I don't see any other hands in terms of people from the working group wanting to make any closing statement or something like that.
Quickly, sorry. Javier Jovet, for the record, on what you just said in terms of size, also consider that the ability of a person to represent that community. So maybe there should be some sort of a, you know, norm to credit that you can speak for a bunch of people.
Robin?
Yeah, I actually would like to piggyback on something both of you guys have just said. Inherent in the awarding of a community TLD is also allowing that registry to decide essentially who to exclude from that TLD. And so I think we have to have that in our minds when we look at this, because we are allowing this group of people to decide who doesn't get to be included in the community, and that's really important. Thanks.
Back to you, Cheryl.
Thank you very much, Alan. And if we progress our slide again, we will get to our next little slot, which, if memory serves, is indeed applicant support. So over to track one. Sarah, you're right? Over to you.
Yes, this is Sarah Bakke for the record. Let's see, so I believe we discussed this previously in Abu Dhabi. As we all know, one of the issues with the applicant support program was its lack of use. During the 2012 round, only three applicants applied, and I think one met the criteria. And so we have been going through and gathering information from ALAC and the community and the GAC. And we actually did get a lot of really good feedback during the last meeting, which was very helpful. I guess we still have a few questions we have regarding, let's see, where are we? I don't know that I need to go through all like the current stats. I think we have a pretty good idea of where we are. Most of this is going to be like implementation recommendations, ways to improve it, because there just wasn't enough outreach, I think, primarily during the last one. So a lot of our recommendations are going to be regarding the promotional efforts, how to better engage with ALAC and GAC members to raise awareness, finding suitable partners in the relevant global areas, implementing training programs. Also looking at utilizing partnerships for that outreach. Definitely looking at support beyond the reduction of the application fees. understanding that it isn't always just about finances, that there are other aspects of the program where we can be help the community to be more successful in an applicant support program, and just better understanding the obstacles that there might be, such as technical support and evaluating the the total cost of what this application the applicant program. I'm losing my train of thought. Understanding the total cost of applying for the GTLD and putting that business together and attorney fees and all of that. So you can go to the next slide. I can't see that far very well. So that's sort of what's outlined here in these bullets, just some of the information that we've received back from everyone. And then go to the next slide. And then we still had some questions that we wanted to pose to the community. And as you can see, is it up there yet? No. Okay, there it is. So feedback that we would like is better understanding the metrics of how we're going to measure a successful program. What are you going to base that on? Is it going to be the number of applications, considerations versus actual applications applied for? Are we going to be looking at business plans and financial sustainability? Moving on, do we want to have an evaluation criteria if there's more applicants than funds? So how do we want to determine who gets that funding? Did we previously provide the right types of tools? What maybe we need to consider moving forward would be good tools for applicants to have. How to best provide locally available consultants, and how do we find that resource? How to improve the learning curve? We've talked about doing possibly mentorships. Is there some other way that we could provide assistance outside of that? Do we want to keep the potential penalization to applicants who may try to game the system, or do we think that trying to block people from gaming the system becomes more of a barrier than it's really worth to the other applicants? And then string contention, how are we going to resolve those? Should there be special considerations for the applicant support program and just dealing with that sort of topic? So those are some areas where we still could stand to have some feedback. So if you all have any ideas, we'd love to hear them.
Who's managing the queue?
Maureen's managing the queue. I'm calling people. I'm first in the queue. Jeff is in the queue. We have me, Tijani, Jeff, and Holly at this point. And Christopher and John. John and Jonathan. Two things that seem to be missing from this. One I know we've talked about, and that is, if they do not meet the criteria for applicant support, should they stay in the race or be eliminated altogether? I don't think that's there, but maybe I missed it.
I don't know that it's necessarily up there, but that is in our recommendations as far as if they fail to meet the criteria for the applicant support, allowing them to go over to the regular application.
Yeah, I just wanted to highlight that, because that was one of the considerations. The one thing I don't see on the list is, where's the money going to come from? Last time the money came from the ICANN board, out of the funding from the applications, but essentially a donation. I can't see that happening again. And you talked about what happens if we have more applicants than funds, but the other question is, how much funds are we going to have, and where is it coming from, and is it funded out of the overall GTLD program or from somewhere else? And I think that's a rather crucial one, because we can decide on everything else, and if we don't have money, it's not going to get anywhere. Next in the queue is Tijani.
Thank you very much. Tijani speaking.
I would like to complete the information you gave, saying that there were only three applications and only one met the criteria. I want to tell you that this one was dropped by the community evaluation panel. So we have zero experience supported the applicant. And this is a problem, because if we had experience, we can say, oh, there is also a problem of sustainability. But we don't have this experience. I think that if we had so few applications, it was because several things. One of them, what Alan said about the ability to apply otherwise if they are not accepted as supported applicant. But I think the most important element was the very tough criteria we put to evaluate or to define what is a supported applicant. And we did that. We put those very bad criteria. I was from the working group who did that, because we are always told it will be gamed. The system will be gamed. I think that this time we have to look it in another way. And I don't know if the criteria will be defined by this group, by the work team one, or it will be defined elsewhere. Thank you.
Any response? Not necessary, just asking. No? Okay. Next we have in the queue Jeff, Holly, Christopher, John Laprise, and Jonathan Zook. Jeff?
Yeah, thanks. Jeff Newman. I may partially respond to that as well. I think what we found as a group, which Jonathan's actually in the queue as well, so he may repeat some of this, because this is, in essence, going to be referred back to us for help from the CCT review team anyway. We're getting nearly universal agreement that nobody liked the result. They didn't think the result was good. We're getting universal agreement that we need to do better. We're getting universal agreement that outreach was not as good as it should have been. We're getting also a number, as Tijani had said, that the criteria might have been too harsh. But what we're not getting is the specifics. Which criteria in particular were too harsh? What are the elements we can fix? What is the, you know, what are the methods of outreach to achieve success? That is the kind of thing that, so our group has been very good at pointing out some of the things that have gone wrong. What we're not getting great information yet is how we improve that. What are your suggestions? And if you can think about that, especially once the initial report comes out, so even if we don't have it prior to the initial report, which should be out in April, and it'll be out for a couple months, it's going to be vital for that response to the initial report. Please provide specifics, because that's what we're looking for. We all know there were problems. We're just trying to figure out how to fix it. Thanks.
That sounded like an advertisement. If you're interested in this thing, maybe join the working group. Each working track advertises ahead of the meeting what they're going to be discussing. We can make sure you're notified if it's the subject of your area, of your interest, and that goes for all the working groups. Holly.
Holly Reich for the Transcript Records. Just a question. Does the actual availability of infrastructure to support internet and internet exchanges and so forth have anything to do with that? And really is a question I don't know. Thank you.
Yeah, sorry, it's Jeff Newman. Do you mean what we have explored is access to technical service providers of registration services. It's a little bit different than internet exchanges. There were some volunteers of registration service providers prior to the last round that said, yes, we would be interested in supporting anyone that wanted to come forward. There's no information as to what they would have offered, and I'm not sure anyone was really taken up on that offer. But again, we need to figure out why. Why is that the case, and how can we make it much more appealable for people to take, for groups to take them up on that offer of assistance?
Yeah, I think I was referring to just really, I do mean basic infrastructure. And is that infrastructure that will support the industry from bottom up? is that there? I mean, look, we've got horrible broadband in Australia, so maybe that's not the thing to talk about.
Yeah, if I may, but Holly, where the registry is where that's important, and that's what Jeff was saying. There was registry service providers who offered their services to supported applicants, but of course we didn't get supported applicants to test that model out.
But to be honest, I've done work in parts of the world where there is abominable internet access in general, but the banks in that country still have good internet access and provide services over it, and so do the telephone companies and things. So in most places, I'm not saying you necessarily want to put the registry there, but in most places there is good internet access to those who are willing to be in the right place and spend enough money. Next we have Christopher.
I just wanted to press your own question a step further and ask, what is there in the budget for next year for this purpose? I think it should be budgeted. And if it's not been budgeted now, when will it be budgeted? And on the last question, I agree that the infrastructure is much better than it was 10 years ago. Some of the CCTLDs, perhaps not all of them, some of the CCTLDs do provide the basic technical capability.
My recollection is that the best forecast we have is 2022 for the next round, 2020.
Jeff is chafing at the bit to respond to.
Whatever the year is, it's not this fiscal year's budget.
Well, this is Jeff Newman, that raises a very good question, this is the budget, the time to talk about the budget. And I'm sure you have or may have already had a meeting to talk about the budget with ICANN staff. And what is critical, if you look at the 2012 round, budgeting process started for that in 2007, with the caveat that they expected it to launch in 2009. The point is that if you expect a round to start in 2 or 3 years, now is the time you start budgeting. And at this point, there is a round that's expected in 2 or 3 years, and therefore there should be budget for it, and there's not. And there's an explicit mention in the budget for fiscal year 19 that says we aren't specifically not allocating any funds for the implementation of subsequent procedures, which is an interesting choice. They could have just said nothing, but they actually wanted to point out that we are putting zero money towards it. They're putting money to help this group, the policy group, finish its work, like all other PDPs, but nothing on implementation. I personally think that's a problem. I've made that comment. The registries, the registrars, the council, and others, if you think that's a problem, which if you want to develop an effective outreach and application support program, it should be a problem, then you should make your voices heard. Thanks.
Thank you. I'll just point out that the money for applicant support isn't needed until the round launches, so that's still it will have to be in the 5-year strategic plan and operational plan.
Well, let me point out, you need people and resources to develop the program to have a place to give money to. So if you don't start developing the program, meaning you're going to have these resources in place, these people devoted to writing the rules, these people devoted to
thank you, Jeff.
Running a bank. That's the point, right?
Thank you. Thank you, Jeff.
Can't just expect it to appear.
We're closing the queue. We have another 4 minutes on this particular one. We have Christopher Spoke, and now we have John LaPrise. We have Jonathan Zook and Sebastian. The queue, and it is closed.
John LaPrise, for the record. I guess I just want to make a comment, and this is definitely out of scope for the work track one, but it seems apparent to me that for all the work we're doing to help people file applications, one other thing that's, I hope, being considered elsewhere is simplification of the whole process. If the process were easier, we would have to provide less support to get new folks to apply. So, thank you.
And a one-minute timer for the rest of the interventions. I missed Tijani, or he was not put in the queue. We have Jonathan Zook.
Two things. One is a question. Aubrey keeps mentioning to me that there was some outreach plan that existed and then was disposed of and replaced by this one that was so sucky, and that she thought the first one was great but was never able to produce it for us. Is that something that you guys have come up with, this mystical first outreach plan? That okay. And I guess my second question is that is the other thing that came up as we were trying to review this was that there was a mentoring program where people could sign up to be mentors and sign up to be mentored, and people signed up to do both of those things, but there's literally no record of anyone actually reaching out to anyone after signing up to be those things. So I don't know if that's part of the plan going forward, but it could be to help navigate some of the complexity, because some of the folks that were doing so many of them were happy to lend services to others. And I guess I'll go back to the very beginning. At the end of your presentation, you said, what are the goals? And I think that you have to start there. What is the objective, and build a plan around that rather than building a plan and then decide later what the metrics are for its success? Because we need to really figure out what the goals are, and if more applicants is the goal, we need to justify that, I think.
Thank you, Jonathan. Tijani.
Thank you, Alan. Alan spoke about the funds that we have to get for the support of applicants. We may give money support, but we can also don't take money, don't take fees, or take very few fees for those applicants. I want to remind everyone that for the 2012 round, we was told that the applicant fees was calculated on the cost recovery, and it was calculated assuming that they will receive 500 applications. They received 2,000. So I don't think that it is a problem for ICANN if we can not take fees for those people who we want to support. Thank you. And yes, last point. You spoke about specifics. You are right, and I thought that this issue was with Robin, with three. So since it is with the group one, I will join this group. Thank you.
Thank you. Where the money comes from is a conscious decision, and it could come from the fees of other applicants. That's a decision. We have a last speaker, Sebastian.
Yeah, just a few words. When Jeff talked about the budget, how many staff was before the last round and how many staff there is today? Therefore, I don't think we need to increase the budget to be able to do the work for the next round. We have already the staff for that. Thank you.
Clearly a management decision. Thank you very much.
I think Jeff does need to respond to that.
I'll just point out this whole program, not just applicant support, is going to have to be designed and implemented. It's a much larger question than applicant support.
It's not a question of, sorry, Jeff Newman, it's not just a question, I don't think we need to add staff, but if you look at the plan, it tells you that it's reallocated staff to different departments. Yeah. And what you need in the budget is a recognition that the staff is allocated back to working on the new TLDs, as opposed to you need additional people.
Thanks, Jeff.
If we have any time at the end, we'll come back to this topic. I know there's some additional interest. Cheryl, topic four.
Thank you very much, Alan. Cheryl Langdon-Orr for the record. And if we move forward at least one, perhaps two slides now, that would be great. And in a perfect world, we're going to have Krista's voice coming in from above. And Krista, are you there?
I am. Can you hear me?
We can. The system works, and it's over to you. We have your first slide of three on the screen.
Great. Thank you. So talking about application fees, there was a little bit of background is that so far we've discussed to date that it should still be revenue neutral. And just like it was in the 2012 round, and because it was new, it was difficult to predict the costs and also the number of applications, as was already mentioned. So a couple of the questions are, is the costing methodology still appropriate going forward? And if we go from rounds to, say, continuous rounds, how would we invest in the systems and other multi-round assets, and how would we allocate those costs in terms of application fees? Just a little bit of background. The working group has actually gone a lot of discussions in terms of the different kind of business models and what would happen to any excess or what should also happen to it. So that kind of ties into the prior discussions and in terms of how you would feed some of the seed money in applicant support. Additionally, the work track has discussed the application fees, including the different costing methods, and some of the aspects that I have kind of, I guess, come forward are a proposed cost floor. And the cost floor is what is the ultimate lowest price that we would be willing to accept for an application, based on the premise that the a new GTLD is a valuable piece of the internet, and to avoid any other issues that we don't want to see occurring. So the cost floor method has kind of come forward on that, and then along with some factors that should be taken into calculating the fees. So with the cost floor, it was if we charge too much, then how do we refund that excess fee? And then how do we also do it in terms of the actual cost and the cost floor? And I know that sounds a little confusing, but I'm hoping it makes a little bit more sense. So I'll stop here and see if there's any questions, just to see if I've explained that well enough.
We have Jonathan. Nope. No questions? I have a question. There has been some discussion in the group that maybe we should use $185,000. And, you know, with the logic that if I paid $185,000 last time, they should have to pay as much. It's a valuable part of the internet. And then we have an interesting question of what it's no longer necessarily cost recovery. And perhaps this is the source of funds that ICANN needs to address its budget problem.
Actually, that's Cheryl Langdon off the record here. I actually find that rather appealing, but that's just me, Bass.
It's not just you. Anyone else? We could go back to applicant support if there's no other interest in this topic.
Sorry, one aspect to consider is that the part of the process of setting the application fee is that there is a costing method that everything goes through in order to determine the $185,000. So I don't know if we can necessarily say that because last time it turned out to be $185,000 after we went through the costing process, that we would still get that same $185,000 if we were to repeat it again today. Or are we not doing the cost-neutral methodology and just saying it's $185,000? So I think there's a little bit of confusion on that, so any feedback would be appreciated.
It's Alan Greenberg speaking. Certainly from my point of view, I wouldn't object to setting it at 185 or higher if indeed that's what the cost is. And I think we could probably find interesting uses for the money. That's my position. We have Christopher. I'll note, when I said we can go back to the other topic, I neglected the fact that we have two more slides after this, and Krista wasn't actually finished.
I just wanted to say that we should not lose sight of the fact that many of the bilateral and multilateral development agencies have priorities for information technology. And it's quite conceivable that a well-prepared project in an underserved region would be eligible. And we should promote that with the with the agencies concerned.
We have...
Well noted.
Sorry?
I'm saying well noted.
We have Jeff next.
Yeah, thanks, Jeff Newman. I'm sorry, I'm going back to Alan, something you said. You can't have something be revenue neutral and say that it's going to be $185,000. Because we know by definition, there's $80 million at least now still left over. And as much as ICANN may want to spend that $80 million, it's we know there's going to be a surplus at some point of a lot of money. So it's either you apply a strict cost neutral, or sorry, revenue neutral model, or you do a revenue neutral model unless it falls below a certain price, at which case you set up a floor because you want to discourage speculation. But you can't say both. You can't say it's revenue neutral and $185,000.
You won't find me claiming, advocating it should be revenue neutral, so I agree completely. I may differ with a lot of other people, but I... Krista, why don't you go ahead with your other slides?
Thanks. So going to the next slide, it was some discussions had been around what to do with the excess fees. So the current ideas are... support the general outreach, support the new GTLD program further, support the applicant support program, and then also, as discussed earlier, to top up any shortfall in the segregated contingency fund. So those are kind of some questions that go back to how that would occur. But the overall thinking of the working group, and this ties back into the actual application fee versus the revenue neutral aspect of it, is that anything above the cost floor would be returned back to the applicants. Only if the amount is different between the cost floor and the actual cost would those excess fees be allocated among these categories. So I hope I've explained that well enough, and of course would appreciate feedback on that as well. And go ahead.
Krista, a question. I think what you just said was there would be a cost floor for the application, but the actual cost of the GTLD when all the dust settles might be lower than that if indeed... There is excess. Is that what I think that's what you're saying.
Exactly.
Thank you. Comments or go on to the third slide and then take everything at once? We have one question from John LaPrise.
John LaPrise for the record. So with respect to the questions, I would say I am I'm disinclined to issue refunds. However, we might consider, and I don't know how feasible this is, but we talked earlier about the issue of communities and giving support to specific communities and creating a separate system for perhaps refunding to those communities that we deem for special treatment.
See, you're suggesting that we might want to have differential pricing depending on the category.
Yes.
Thank you. Chris, any other? We have no other in the queue. Krista, we'll back to you.
Okay. So going to another question is the other aspect of, one, there is a costing process and it's complete. And if there are different application fee amounts that are significantly different between the different applications, should we consider a different application fee by the type of application? For instance, if a brand application costs significantly less than, say, a community application due to just the amount of resources it takes, and that number is significantly different, should we entertain the idea of having different application fees? I'll go to the a couple more questions. I guess the last one would be consideration or implications if we move to continuous rounds versus, the current rounds.
Just for the record, we haven't covered that here. At this point, we're talking about a round, possibly even another round, but maybe ultimately moving to simply continuous applications and not having explicit rounds or something in between that. So that's the reference in the last one. We have Tijani, and then I'd like to go back to Krista. We're down to about 7 minutes. So Tijani, then back to Krista for the rest of the slides.
Thank you, Alan. Tijani speaking. I agree with you, Krista, about having different fees for different application. And I think this is the wise way to do it. And we spoke about that before. We spoke about that before, especially for the support for the applicants and also for the communities. The last point about one round or several rounds, I think that we have to get one round and stop it at a certain time. If you put it open, we know why. Why there is a problem now, not a problem, a different point of view between the community elements regarding opening a new round now. It is because we want to learn from the round. And if we let it open, we will not learn, and we will have perhaps a catastrophe.
Whether it's one round or multiple rounds or continuous is not the subject of today's discussion, but do join that working group, because it's an interesting discussion because of string contention. Mm. If you take every applicant as it comes, you never have any string contention, and it's first come, first serve. So that's the issue there, but it's not today's topic. Krista, back to you.
I don't have anything else, just other than hopefully some additional feedback on saying the costing floor and how to use the excess and any other ideas that anyone can provide.
Your slide says 2 of 3, so I'm assuming there's a third.
Let's progress the slide and see what it says. It could be there, it could be nothing, it could be general questions. That's it. Well, I don't know. I think that's false advertising, ladies and gentlemen. I, for one, Cheryl Langdon, off the record, am disappointed bitterly that we don't have another slide for Krista to talk to.
We will. Any last questions before we wrap? All right, then I'll turn it back to Cheryl. Then I have something to say.
Thank you very much, Alan. Cheryl Langdon, off the record, and I'll also hand it over to Jeff before I give it back to you. I wanted to thank all of the work track leads from the PDP here that they've come literally at the end of what can only be described as a relatively long day on this subject. And Krista, who's mid-finalising her thesis, thank you. You are an example of the ridiculous amount of pressure and time we take out of volunteers' lives. I'm just so pleased that you could even join us today. I really want to give you all of our thanks for doing that. But it is a huge task to run these work tracks, and what you have all done today is given them fresh food for thought. And I think I can say on behalf of the work track leads that we really appreciate this interaction with the ALAC and at large. So thank you, Alan, for setting this up and picking such cheeky and exciting little topics. Jeff, what would you like to say?
Yeah, I think I'll make it short. This is Jeff Newman. Thank you for inviting us. I think this is the second time in a row now that you've invited us to come and speak with you, and this has been very valuable for us, and we hope that you continue to invite us and that we can exchange ideas like this. So thank you.
Or you can finish the PDP quickly and we won't have a chance to invite you.
There is that.
Some of you may be familiar. Any of you familiar with Alcoholics Anonymous? Alcoholics Anonymous is a treatment group for alcoholics.
I'm not sure you're allowed to.
Let me go with it. And the process is when someone goes into one of these meetings, they start off with a statement that's roughly equivalent to, "My name is Alan Greenberg, and I'm an alcoholic." It's admitting it. Okay. "My name is Alan Greenberg, and I'm a work group masochist." A masochist, someone who does nasty things to themselves. "I'm a member of all of the work of the main PDP and all of the working groups, and I actually try to attend most of the meetings when they're not held at 3 a.m. and occasionally some of those." These working groups all, with the exception of Work Track 5, which is dedicated to one subject, all of the other work tracks have a whole bunch of subjects that they're working on. Some of them are really intriguing, like some of the ones we talked about here. Some of them are, from my perspective, boring as hell.
You're not talking about my technical ones.
I wouldn't be talking about any particular one. The work track leaders, some of whom have very strong opinions on some of the subjects that they're working on, are doing an unbelievable job from what I'm watching. Yeah. They are dedicated. They are tackling all of the subjects, even the boring ones, well, and are uniformly, even when they have strong personal positions, are running a really clean show. And I would like to take my hat off, or if I was wearing a hat, the amount of work that is being done and how well it is being done is just amazing, and I thank you all. And the same, of course, goes for the work group co-chairs.
Oh,
but they get all the glory, so we don't need to thank them a lot. Thank you all. You have my respect. That is the end of this session. It is the end of our day for At Large, and it's been a long day. I would like to thank everyone for participation. There's been really good turnout throughout the day, except for when I wasn't here, and I'm not sure how well it was, but I guess it was pretty good. It was better when I wasn't here. I can do that again. And I'd like to thank our technical crew, because everything has worked marvelously. And, of course, our interpreters, who are doing, again, a yeoman job, even if we don't announce who we are each time. Thank you all. We'll see most of you tomorrow.